Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll preview the Northern Utah Conference to End Violence, which is presented by the USU Office of the President and CAPSA. It's happening next week, Wednesday, May 29th. Topics will include domestic violence in the workplace, stalking, empowerment, courts, vicarious trauma, and many other topics. Our guests are CAPSA Social Services Director Michaela Hansey and Emily Fishburne, who is CAPSA's Director of Projects and Initiatives. We hope you join us for the discussion following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll preview the Northern Utah Conference to End Violence. That's presented by the USU Office of the President and CAPSA. It's happening next week, Wednesday, May 29th. Topics will include domestic violence in the workplace, stalking, empowerment, courts, vicarious trauma, and other topics. Our guests today are CAPSA Social Services Director Michaela Hansey. Michaela Hansey, thanks for coming in.
Hey, thanks, Tom, for having us.
Appreciate it. And Emily Fishburne is CAPSA's Director of Projects and Initiatives. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
So we want to preview the conference. This will be useful even for people who can't go to the conference because these are topics that it will be useful to know about. Maybe we could start with the conference. Emily, do you want to tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, sure.
Today, the reason we're doing this program today is the last day to register. It is free, but you do need to register.
Yeah, that is correct. So the conference is free. You do need to register. Today is the last day to register for it. I will say for the first time in its history, it is already sold out, and it does have a wait list, which we're really excited about. When we started the conference 2 years ago, this is our third one, the goal was to get it to the point where it was so popular that it sold out that we'd have to find a new venue, expand our horizons. And so we're excited that 3 years in, we've gotten there.
And I assume the purpose of the conference is in the title.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's important for the community to recognize that addressing domestic and sexual violence isn't just the role of an agency like CAPSA. It really is the whole community's role to come together, to be collaborative, to work together, and to figure out how we can create the best outcomes for survivors in our community.
So this is a collaboration between USU Office of the President, in fact, President Cantwell will be one of the presenters, and CAPSA. So Michaela, tell us, for people who don't know what CAPSA is, what is CAPSA?
Yeah, CAPSA is Cache Valley and Rich Counties Sexual Assault and Rape Recovery Center, as well as domestic violence services for victims of domestic violence. So we are a nonprofit serving also the Preston and Franklin area, as well as Rich and Cache County. What most people think of when they hear CAPSA is our shelter, but we actually have a lot of expansive services that survivors can utilize.
Yeah. Let me do this. I'll try to remember to do this periodically. CAPSA's 24-hour support line, 435-753-2500. You go to CAPSA.org as well to get help. I don't know what the stats are, just in general. Were you getting better, getting worse? These problems are always with us, unfortunately. And this conference is, a project to end violence, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if we're doing better, doing worse here in Cache Valley.
That would be our goal, would be to end violence. But, it's much more prevalent than I think people realize. And I wouldn't say it's getting better, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Utah's statistics are higher than the national average. So here in Utah, 1 in 3 will experience domestic violence, 1 in 3 women. And the national average is a little bit lower. That's one of the reasons I think it's important we're hosting this conference, is to bring awareness to this topic and do what we can to help prevent that.
Yeah. Emily, I wonder if you'd talk, probably both, but start with Emily. Talk about what some of the warning signs are, if you have a friend or family member maybe in trouble. mm-hmm. what and how you can tell maybe something's going on, and then how to help that person.
Sure. So there's a lot of signs of domestic violence in particular that people might not even realize are signs of domestic violence. So domestic violence is characterized by an imbalance of power and control. So the abusive person in the relationship is the person who exercises more power and control over the person that is being victimized. And so things that you can be on the lookout for are things like someone being isolated, so being cut off from their friends or their family members, someone being told what to do about lots of different kinds of things. It could be how they dress, what they eat, who they talk to, where they go, what they're allowed to do or not do. And we can also see just really signs of emotional distress. So someone that is having really heightened emotions related to things that maybe the average person who wasn't experiencing these things wouldn't be reacting so emotionally related to. Domestic violence can also be characterized by people having a lot of fear, just fear of where that abusive partner is, what that abusive partner knows about what they're doing or what they're not doing. And then the last big one that we see a lot is tracking behaviors. So monitoring behaviors, whether that's someone having to check in periodically and say, this is where I'm at, either prove that through a phone call, a text message, even sometimes a picture or a video recording. But other times it might also be people just making comments that, like, my partner requires me to keep my location services turned on at all times. So when we think about how we can support people if we do notice these signs, one of the biggest things is being supportive but non-judgmental. I think it can be really easy for people who are not experiencing abuse to say, well, why would you stay? Or, you know, that's not love, so why are you sticking around or why are you putting up with that? And the reality is that abusive relationships are not always abusive. They do have periods of positivity or love or even just support from that abusive partner, and that's what makes it challenging for someone to leave. And so when we're being supportive, part of it is referring to resources such as CAPSA or another local domestic violence or sexual assault agency in the state. But then also just being there to listen to people, reminding them that they are cared for and that they are loved and they don't deserve how they're being treated, but ultimately letting them make the choice about what happens next for them.
Mm. Michaela Hansey, anything else you'd like to say on that? Then I have a follow-up question.
Yeah. You know, one of the worst things that someone can say to someone who is experiencing abuse is, if you go back to them, then I'm not going to be here for you anymore. Giving them that ultimatum, and ultimately that would drive the person to probably stay with their abusive partner. So I would say the right thing to say would be, I'm here for you. I'm worried about you. I'm seeing some red flags and I care about you. And here's CAPSA's information. And then letting them make the decision to leave when they're ready. And oftentimes it takes, I think they say 7 times for someone to leave their abusive relationship before they're actually done. So providing them the resources and being there for them, I think those are the biggest things I want people to know.
Mm. So we've talked about the kind of the emotional pull, right? There can be some love in there and some emotional pull. There's also sometimes danger, right? The person be afraid. What if it becomes after me, etc.
Yeah.
So how do you handle that as a friend or family member?
Yeah, I think expressing concern for their safety and expressing when they see things are escalating, providing them a safe place to stay, or again a referral to CAPSA. I mean, I think that's probably the biggest concern. Or we get a lot of calls too from family members and friends, church leaders and things to CAPSA saying, I have this situation, this person I'm really worried about. How do I help them? And those are perfectly appropriate calls to CAPSA, too. We want to help those that also care about the victim.
What, you call it some number if you're a
yep.
clergyman or somebody wanting to help somebody?
Okay. Yes, yep, all the same number.
All right. 435-753-2500. So Emily Fishburne, I'm seeing here on CAPSA. It's a very attractive website, and it's, I don't know who's in charge of this, but kudos. flashes through different images. One of the what comes up is We Believe You.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder where we are with that in this Me Too, post-Me Too. I don't know where we are with is that still as big a problem as it was, or has we made progress there?
I think that's a fair question to ask. I think that we have made progress, but there's still a lot of challenges related to that belief. I think especially when it comes to domestic violence. Often domestic violence is being perpetrated by people that the victims, people know, right? So it could be someone in their community. It could be someone that behaves in a very different way in public than they do in private. And it does make it really challenging for people in the community to believe survivors when they come forward and say that they've had these experiences, because it's really easy for those people to say, well, that's not how they act around me, or I've never seen them behave that way, so you must be making it up. And so we have a lot of progress still to go on that belief aspect, which is, it's a cornerstone of CAPS's work. It's on our website. It's on the lanyards that all the staff wear. It's pretty prominently displayed within our building, because sometimes it's the very first time that a survivor has gotten that message from their community is when they come into our building to receive care from us.
Again, I'm reading you from the website here, Michaela Hansi. We've talked about physical abuse. It's also emotional, right? Mm-hmm. Psychological, you talk about stalking here, neglect.
Yep.
So the full range of ways the person be abused.
Yeah. You know, we often have people come in and say, I'm not even sure if I'm supposed to be here because my partner hasn't hit me, or I wasn't raped. But that's definitely not the case in all situations. And the abuse can be very serious, even if those elements don't exist. And that's one thing I want people also to realize, too, is that emotional, psychological, financial, all of that is taken very seriously at CAPSA. And the services are available to you. I used to run a support group, actually, and in every single group I ever ran, a majority of the women would say that the psychological and emotional abuse was much more difficult to deal with than the physical abuse that their partner would do. So, yeah.
I wanted to spend a little more time on financial abuse, exploitation, right? This gets into control, I would assume, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I would say financial abuse can look a couple different ways, but one is the more obvious one is controlling the finances, not allowing them to have access to bank accounts or important documents, or making financial decisions, or the other way I also see it is destroying their partner's credit, or putting everything in their name so that they're responsible for the debt. Any way that they can control and sabotage the financial situation for the other one. And also, it's one of the biggest barriers we see for people trying to leave abusive relationships, feeling like they can't make it financially without their partner. That's a huge barrier. So that's something that we address and can work through at CAPSA.
Yeah. Emily Fishburne, I wonder what's one or several, misunderstandings that we would the public have? Do you think that you'd like to correct about domestic violence or abuse?
I think probably the biggest one is that someone was asking to be abused, I think, is a really common one that we still hear, both on the sexual assault side, but also on the domestic violence side. I think it goes back to something that, you know, Michaela said earlier, where people in the community can sometimes give that ultimatum that says, well, if you stick around, then I'm not going to be here for you anymore. And I think it's important for us to recognize that people never choose to be abused. It's the abuser that makes the choice to engage in those abusive behaviors. And sometimes the choice to stay is actually the safest choice to make, because survivors know what could happen to them if they decide to leave. And in fact, it's way more dangerous when you're leaving an abusive relationship than at any other point in the relationship, mm-hmm. because the violence can escalate. And so people are smart. Victims and survivors are incredibly smart people. They know how to protect themselves. And we as the community have to believe that of them, that if they are not leaving, they have a really important reason for why they're not deciding to get out of that relationship at this point in time.
Yeah. Michaela Hansi, Emily just said the leaving is the most dangerous time. As a friend, family member, how do you navigate that? I guess you'd obviously want to get them to CAPSA or some other type shelter. But I guess you make a plan, right? What do you do?
Yeah. those 30 to 60 days and even up to 6 months after are some of the most dangerous times to leave. But yeah, that's one of the things we do with survivors at CAPSA is make an action plan. And oftentimes family and friends, it's great to have them involved in their action plan, around how are we going to stay safe? What's next? This might be a temporary situation. But then what are we going to be doing as our next steps? And really just providing that support around that survivor at that time, through all aspects, friends, family, CAPSA is going to be the most crucial.
Yeah. Emily, I wonder, you know, there might be people listening who have, are being abused right now, or family, friends, family members, maybe provide them a little hope. I'm sure both of you have worked with many people who've come in and have a better life now, right? I guess lack of hope can be a problem, I would imagine.
Yeah, it can definitely be a barrier to what we call help-seeking, that ability to really make that phone call to CAPSA, or even to tell someone in your life that you've had an experience of sexual assault or abuse or domestic violence. If we feel like things can't get better by talking about things, then it's really challenging for us to come forward. And I think the reality is that there's no guarantee that they're going to get better right away. But definitely what Michaela's team, especially as the caseworkers who work with our survivors, you know, on the front lines every day, is they do see progress. It just might not be very fast. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it takes a long time to get to that point where we are seeing that hope and able to move forward from these really traumatic experiences. So yeah. It's a natural reaction to feel hopeless, but it's important to recognize that there are people out there, such as CAPSA, that can be supportive and can bring some of that hope back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I wonder if you talk about that as well, that obviously, I guess, I would imagine the goal of CAPSA is, you know, solve the immediate crisis, but then help the person to get to thriving, right? Not just surviving, but thriving.
Yes. Yeah. You know, it's one of my favorite things as I get to supervise our casework team is watching survivors and as a caseworker myself in the past too, is watching people come in, you know, with little confidence or worried that what they might say may be the wrong thing or that they shouldn't even be there or, you know, physically seeing the state that they're in when they come in sometimes and then watching them as they leave the caseworker's office, you know, standing a little taller with a little bit more hope in their eyes. That's one of my favorite things. And what I would like to say to everyone too is we're not going to make you do anything at CAPSA. We don't force people to leave their relationships. We're there to help you with what you think is best and to help you stay safe and take those next steps if you want to. But yeah, just because you come in and talk to us doesn't mean that you are leaving your relationship. We just like to provide people with, you know, that hope and options. And it has, over the years, I've had several stories about people that have come in and been in a state where they didn't think anything would get any better. And after a period of time of working together and doing the hard work, you know, I mean, I got to give a lot of the credit to the survivors. They're the ones that are actually doing the work. We're just providing the hope and the tools sometimes. And I've had survivors call me years later and say, thank you. What we talked about in your office that day or that thing that you said to me has stuck with me all these years. And I wanted to tell you how great I'm doing now and how good my family is. So that's why we do it, is to hear those stories.
Emily Fishburne, we head toward a break here, but I, again, looking at the CAPSA website, you have the cycle of abuse. You have this pretty prominent. I think this is important, especially for friends and family, maybe even for survivors to recognize it in their lives, probably. Tension building, acute violence, reconciliation, honeymoon phase, right?
Mm-hmm.
Important to recognize this because, as you were saying earlier, there are some reasons why survivors do stay.
Yeah.
There are periods where it is calm, although it will probably always start up again.
It will. And the cycle of abuse is a big thing that Michaela's team and our therapy team really talks to our survivors about a lot, because as you said, it's not something that people are necessarily aware of. And I think once you're able to help someone understand that this is a pattern, it's going to repeat itself, even if there is a long period of time between the honeymoon phase and then the next kind of explosive or abusive incident, it still is going to come back around. It's the hallmark of abusive relationships in many regards. And so it does help family members understand that, but it also helps survivors understand that. It also helps us understand why we might be more willing to leave a relationship during certain periods of that cycle versus less willing to leave during other periods of that cycle.
Michaela, you want to talk anything more about the cycle of violence?
It's a great tool that can help survivors understand what they're experiencing. I think oftentimes people will come in and they describe it all as like a blur. You know, everything's just a gray blur, and they can't pinpoint, you know, what the abusive behaviors, or they can't label the abusive behaviors, but giving them those words and helping them identify, like, especially the honeymoon phase of why that gives their abuser control in the relationship is really empowering for them to understand what they're experiencing.
Let's head toward a break. We are previewing the... we'll get into previewing the... We're talking about CAPSA here, which is all great. The Northern Utah Conference to End Violence, which is sponsored, presented by the USU Office of the President and CAPSA. So, Emily Fishburn, today is the last day to register. It is free. You do need to register. Maybe a few spots left. How to register?
Yeah, so you can go on to the conference's website. It is nucev.usu.edu, and there is a big registration button that says register for the conference or something like that.
Okay, excellent. Tell us that website again.
Yep, nucev.usu.edu.
And we are talking with two folks who work for CAPSA, CAPSA Social Services Director Michaela Hansey, and Emily Fishburn, who's CAPSA's Director of Projects and Initiatives. And we'll have more following this brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're previewing the Northern Utah Conference to End Violence. It's being presented by the USU Office of the President and CAPSA. It's happening next week, Wednesday, May 29th. Today is the last day to register. It's free, but you do need to register. Emily Fishburn, where to go again?
Yes, so you can go to the conference's website. It is nucev.usu.edu, and there will be a big register button on that page.
All right, great. And that's Emily Fishburn, CAPSA's Director of Projects and Initiatives. We also have with us CAPSA Social Services Director Michaela Hansey. We're going to be talking here about some of the topics to be addressed in the Northern Utah Conference to End Violence. I want to start with stalking, addressing stalking, collaborative approach. That's one of those forms of abuse, right?
Yes.
Who wants to take this one?
Yeah, I can. So, yeah, there's a lot of research, more research coming out about stalking as of the last several years and the seriousness of it, and how it really directly correlates to some of the most potentially lethal situations. So we're really excited to have some presenters from the Cache County Attorney's Office talking to the attendees about this serious topic and how we should be paying attention to it. It's often connected with domestic violence, but could be underlooked, or the seriousness of it is not always immediately seen. But if we dig into the cases a little bit more and see that this is an element, you know, it's definitely something that we're paying attention to, and that the community also needs to know about as a serious part of domestic violence. So,
and I can see this is connected with, could be very much connected with control, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or attempted control.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, and monitoring behaviors more broadly.
Yeah.
That's really like the kind of characterization of stalking, is some sort of pattern of monitoring someone in a way that causes them distress. So monitoring can look like a lot of different things. It could be literally following someone around, but it could also be requiring things like location services to be turned on. It can also be characterized by things like showing up places unannounced, but because you know that person will be there.
Yeah. Another breakout session is called Empowerment, Helping Survivors Navigate the Resources and Decision-Making. I just want to read the paragraph here. As a victim service provider, one of the most important things for us is to keep in mind is that most people we serve have had their ability to consent taken from them. So empowerment is especially important. Michaela.
Yeah, I mean, exactly what you said is they haven't often had a voice or the choice of what direction to take their life. So that's one of the first things from someone seeking services that we like to give them, is the options, and have them really direct what direction they want to be going in. And we're there to support them and empower them to make those decisions.
Similarly, the presenter here will be Sean Anderson with USU Savvy Office. Might be a good time to point out that USU, as college and universities, do have services.
Yeah, absolutely. So SAVI is Utah State's Sexual Assault and Anti-Violence Information Office, SAVI, and they do provide free and confidential services to both students and employees across the entire university system. So they're based at Logan physically, but they do have virtual services that are available for all students and employees throughout the state of Utah. And their services are similar to CAPSA's in that they do provide casework and direct referrals over to resources, and they are intended to be that supportive, soft landing spot for people after they've experienced trauma and abuse.
Yeah. Brings to mind, because I've had some training here, you know, required training at USU. I think survivors might be worried if I tell anybody, especially anybody kind of semi-official, then this will have to turn into a police report.
Yeah, that is a fear, especially in the university system, because colleges and universities do have what are called mandatory reporters related to this kind of information. And so SAVI for university students and employees is that confidential landing spot where that information does not have to be reported, doesn't automatically create a police report. And I think it's important for Michaela to also share what CAPSA's reporting obligations are, because we are a confidential resource in the community, but we also do have some reporting obligations similar to what the university has.
Yeah, tell us about that.
So our services are also confidential, meaning if someone comes in, they need to know that they can share what they need to, and we are going to keep that information there in that room so they can feel safe sharing. We do share with them that there are some laws that we do have to follow regarding reporting, and that is if they tell us about any children being abused or elderly or vulnerable adults, as well as if they're feeling suicidal, and we believe that if they leave, they will be a direct harm to themselves. Those are the things that we would need to report if we discussed. But again, we like people to know that this is a confidential, safe place for them to disclose what they've been experiencing.
And I believe even if it's reported to police, you don't necessarily have to prosecute, right? If you don't want to.
Yeah, so we talk a lot with our survivors about the option of reporting to law enforcement and really telling them what that might look like. And they have a choice of whether they want to report that or not. And the reporting that we're doing is to, like, the Division of Child and Family Services or Adult Protective Services.
Now, if you're outside of this, I could see people saying, well, of course, prosecute, go for it, get the perpetrator. But it's a lot more complicated, right?
Yep, a lot more complicated. I think there could be, to have that victim have to go through the whole criminal justice system process, as the survivor, even though it's the offender being held accountable, can be a long process, potentially having to testify or have it be in the news, or even their partner losing their job, which would mean them losing child support. There's a lot of factors that go into whether someone wants to report or not.
Yeah. Here's a session I think would be especially important. Leading the charge against vicarious trauma. Understanding burnout, compassion fatigue, vicarious trauma, and what you can do about it. Maybe start with Emily Fishburne here. This, I think many of us are aware of during COVID, during the pandemic, a lot of healthcare worker burnout, frankly. And people left the field. Mm-hmm. Just too much, right?
Yeah.
I guess that can be a danger in this field, vicarious trauma, right? Compassion fatigue.
Yeah, it obviously can be, because you're hearing really personal stories multiple times a day. And the people who do this work, our caseworkers, our therapists, healthcare providers, as you said, often go into this work because they're caring, compassionate people, and they want to help other people succeed and move forward from things that they've experienced. And it's not possible to fully disconnect from that, right? To fully disconnect from hearing people's stories and the emotions that are associated with them, and to not have some sort of emotional reaction yourself. So we were really excited to see this particular presentation come through as part of this year's conference, because we do think it's important not only for the community to understand how to address these things, but also for the community that is doing the work of supporting people to recognize that we can't keep taking care of other people if we aren't taking care of ourselves.
Yeah. Michaela Hansi, I don't know if you've seen this experience, that I could see it would be a potential problem, right?
Yeah.
You're dealing with just horrible situations, and you're loving the people you're working with, but you can't get too involved emotionally, but you have to be somewhat involved emotionally.
Right.
So how do you navigate that?
Yeah, it's a fine balance for sure. you know, people don't go into this field often for the money. So they're going into it because they care about helping other individuals. And if there's a high turnover in that, then really how are we moving the work forward? Like, how are we improving our systems and our responses if the field has consistent turnover? So I think this is a really important topic and something that we honestly just have to talk about. So it's a great topic for the conference, and also I hope it becomes an ongoing topic for attendees as well, taking care of ourselves so that we can continue to do this work.
Yeah. Emily Fishburne, I'd imagine this would also be a danger for a family member.
Yeah.
Vicarious trauma. You're dealing with a family member, trying to help them, trying to get them out.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think, I mean, again, going back to what Michaela said earlier, where sometimes people share those ultimatums of you need to get out or I won't be here. Sometimes they're also doing that as self-protection for themselves, of saying, I don't have the emotional bandwidth anymore to keep supporting you through this or to keep listening to this. And so it's important for what we call secondary survivors, so friends and family members of survivors of violence and abuse, to get help themselves. They also need an outlet, and they also need support. And I know that CAPSA can provide that support to folks, SAVI can provide that support to folks mm-hmm. at the university, but also just general mental health resources in the community can provide that support too.
Yeah. So can secondary survivors call CAPSA, I guess?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. So I imagine you could get them some help, at least some advice, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Excellent. I'm just going down through the breakout sessions here. Again, we're talking with two members of CAPSA, talking about the Northern Utah Violence, Northern Utah Conference doing violence. And that is next week, Wednesday, May 29th, on the USU campus. You do. It's free, but you have to register today. So, Emily, what's the website again to register?
You can register at nucev.usu.edu.
All right. I notice there's a session on ending sexual violence in the military, which is, as we've heard in the news, is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who wants to talk about this. Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely something that's been in the media over the last several years, and we're grateful to have this session brought to this conference so that we can address what's happening here in Utah regarding that. We have some folks from the National Guard that are coming to talk about their work and what they're doing to combat that in Utah and address this issue and how they're taking it seriously.
Yeah. There's been legislation, there's some slow movement, but some movement on this topic. Here's one that I kind of recoil from, and you wouldn't have to have this breakout, but I guess we do. Dangers of strangulation. We'll be discussing the anatomy and function of the structures in the neck, and I think about why we're doing that. I recoil from that, as I said, but I guess this is a danger. This is part of the violence that happens.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the most dangerous signs of domestic violence. You know, I talked about stalking being an indicator that a situation could be potentially lethal, and strangulation is probably more so even higher than that. And it's also a topic that a lot more research has come out about in the last several years. And a lot of places are actually doing what they call like IPV exams, intimate partner violence examinations, because the seriousness of being strangled can have a lot of lasting health effects, and prosecuting these cases is very important. Strangulation is a felony, and so gathering that evidence from an exam and also making sure that the survivor's health is you know, maintained and that they're able to get the help that they need is so important. So yeah, we're really excited to have Trish come and talk to us about the seriousness and the availability of these kinds of exams.
Yeah, I guess the exam is available, mm-hmm. so you could take that if you want. That could lead to criminal prosecution, I suppose, or not. I don't know.
Yeah. Yep. So law enforcement takes strangulation very seriously, and will prosecute that if that's a factor.
Here's another breakout session: Hope, Justice, and Healing: Using Courts and Legal Processes to Help Victims Heal, Hold Killers Accountable, and Recover After Homicide. Brandon Merrill is going to present this one. He's with the Utah Homicide Survivors. So I guess this is, you know, if you decide to prosecute, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. What we know and what Michaela has been sharing is that some survivors choose that they want to go the prosecution route and interact with law enforcement and go through the criminal system. And so one of the things that we focus on with this conference is bringing folks together from law enforcement, but also from victim service providers such as CAPSA, community members, nonprofit agencies such as Brandon Merrill's, to really talk through what does a process through the court system that is survivor-centered as much as is reasonably possible to be, what would that actually look like, and how can we make sure that if a survivor is choosing to go through the criminal system, that they are getting care and support throughout that process as well, again, as much as is possible within a criminal system that does need to be relatively neutral.
Yeah. Another session is called LGBTQ Plus 101. I don't know if you have the figures in front of you. Is it similar rates of domestic violence among that population, or higher or lower?
You know, I think that's an area that's definitely underreported.
Mm.
From what we know, there is abuse happening in these relationships, but there's also a lot more barriers as to why they may not be willing to share that that's happening to them. So I think it's underreported and something that we want people to know, that there is help available, you know.
Another session, supporting LGBTQ plus youth, positive adult relationships become violence prevention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we know that in communities and families and states that maybe are not supportive of LGBTQ individuals, family members can choose to disassociate from their youth who do come out as being a member of that community. Sometimes disassociation means kicking them out of the house, and that increases homeless rates for individuals who are LGBTQ. So, you know, one of the things that we try to do at this conference when we think about collaboration is not just collaboration across different disciplines or different, you know, fields of work, but also collaboration across different communities and recognizing that LGBTQ individuals, as Michaela said, they do underreport their experiences. They also experience violence at much higher rates, mm-hmm, than non-LGBTQ individuals. And so the family can be a supportive place for people when they come out as LGBTQ, but it can also be a very unsupportive place when, mm-hmm, people come out, and that can increase their experiences of violence as a result if it is unsupportive.
Yeah. Here's another session presented by my friend Reese Nielsen. I'll give a shout out to Reese. The role and power of family in ending violence. How to do family right. Talks about community, of course, right, and services like CAPSA, but family can be a powerful influence for good or ill, I suppose, with this.
Yeah, absolutely. We know that a factor in someone engaging in abusive behaviors as, you know, they age is experiencing abuse in their own childhood home. And so one of the things that is important for our community to recognize is that when we create safe, supportive, welcoming, respectful environments in the home, we actually are decreasing rates of violence within our community. But that can be really challenging to do, because if we grew up in a home that was violent, we were taught that those behaviors were okay. And it can be very challenging to break that, what is called a intergenerational cycle of abuse. And so one of the things that the Family Place tries to do is really break that cycle. And so they are a great resource in the Cache Valley community for really helping families think about how do we have better coping skills, or how do we have disagreements in a more healthy way, or how do we model behaviors that are not abusive but are actually supportive and caring for our children.
I guess you're going to have a session on Senate Bill 117. I think it was passed last year, right? Sponsored by Senator Todd Weiler. We've talked about this a little bit on this program. Which requires all police agencies to conduct lethality assessments. What's that?
Yeah, so the lethality assessment is a tool that law enforcement uses when they go on domestic violence calls, where they sit down with the victim and ask them a series of questions that, you know, can help potentially predict their likelihood of being killed by their partner. And then the tool, like the protocol, actually helps connect the victim right there on scene to CAPSA services. We've seen huge success with this in Cache County. We actually piloted this program in 2015 and have been doing it since then. And the rest of Utah is kind of getting on board as of last year, because it's a law to do this now. But we have great relationships with law enforcement, and the fact that they will sit down with victims and ask them these questions and express their concern for their safety and say, I want to connect you to CAPSA because I am worried about your safety really reduces that barrier of that victim having to call in and ask for help themselves. That's usually the biggest barrier is that first phone call. So they're there to make that happen. And also it's super influential to have an officer tell you that they are worried about your safety and that they want to connect you with somebody that they trust, like CAPSA, to give them help. So we see a lot of referrals coming to CAPSA from this protocol. And yeah, we're really excited that it's become a law, and we think it's going to help a lot more communities in Utah. And they're here to share a session with us about how that work is going.
Yeah, very good. I notice, Emily, there's an introduction to practicing cultural competency. And I guess that's in conversations and situations as freighted as these, culture is going to come into it.
Yeah, absolutely. So cultural competency is the idea that we recognize that people come from different backgrounds and belief systems, and that influences not only their experiences of violence and abuse, but how they perceive that violence and abuse. And so that particular session is going to focus, I think, especially on immigrant and refugee communities and their experiences of violence and abuse, but also, again, their cultural understandings of those things, which can be different than folks that have come from different parts of the world, such as the United States. And it's important as service providers, but also as community members, to not judge people who might be coming from cultures or backgrounds that say that this violence is okay, or that this is just what it means to be in a relationship or what it means to be a part of a family. It's important for us to take that supportive but also educational tone to say, we recognize this might be, you know, what you grew up with or where you were taught, but here in, you know, our country and our community, that's not something that we believe in, helping people recognize that what they've experienced isn't actually okay, even if maybe that's what they were taught, but doing it in such a way that is non-judgmental, which is a very fine line to really walk when you're supporting people whose belief system or cultural background is very different from the community that maybe they're now living in.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with a brief final segment. We're talking about the Northern Utah Conference to End Violence. It is presented by the USU President's Office and CAPSA. And we're talking with CAPSA Social Services Director Michaela Hansey and Emily Fishburne, who is CAPSA's Director of Projects and Initiatives. Emily, what's that website again?
It is.
I haven't written it down, so I'll rely on you.
It is nucev.usu.edu, and there will be a big registration button on that landing page.
All right. Today's last day to register. It is free, but you do have to register. The conference happens next week, Wednesday, May 29th. We'll have a brief break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're previewing the Northern Utah Conference to End Violence. It's happening Wednesday, May 29th, next week. But today's the last day to register. It is free, but you do need to register. So one more time, Elby, what's the website?
Yeah, the conference's website is nucev.usu.edu.
You can register there. We're talking with Emily Fishburne, CAPSA's Director of Projects and Initiatives, and with CAPSA Social Services Director, Michaela Hansey. Just, I think, one more thing on the conference. The speakers will include USU President Elizabeth Cantwell. She's made ending sexual violence a big plank in her platform. Jill Anderson, your CEO, CAPSA will be talking as well. The keynoter is Rachel Louise Snyder, author of, among other books, No Visible Bruises. Anything you want to say about her?
Yeah, we're really excited that Rachel Louise Snyder is coming to be the keynote for this year's conference. So this is our third conference. The first two keynote speakers for the previous conferences were local individuals who share their stories, and so it's cool to have a national person come in and speak to us. Rachel is best known, at least more recently, for her investigative reporting related to domestic violence. And so we are excited to host her so that attendees can really learn about what she uncovered within, it was a decade plus of research that went into that No Visible Bruises book that she published a few years ago. And so her message is really going to focus on the role of collaboration in the community and what it takes to end domestic violence in our communities, which is not just relying on social services like CAPSA, but really saying we all need to take this seriously collectively as a community.
Mm-hmm. What does that look like, do you think, to, I guess, get the word out, programs like this, right? But I'll phrase it this way. Do you think we're making progress in having the whole community take this seriously?
I think we are making progress, maybe not as quickly as you would always hope, right? Because these are really deeply embedded issues within our society, whether or not we want to accept that as true or not. But I think what we are noticing is when our prevention education team goes into the schools, the kinds of conversations they're having with our students are different than they used to be 5-10 years ago, where students are more aware of ideas like consent or healthy relationships or boundary setting. And so it's a little bit less of starting at square one and a little bit more of starting at like square two, where, you know, they have some foundational understanding. We're able to build on that a little bit more and speak more to it. I think the more that we talk about these issues, the more that the community is confronted with having to think about them. And part of that process of thinking about them is really recognizing that these behaviors are all around us. And we have a lot of people in our lives who are having these experiences. And that's really hard to accept. But I think it's also important to accept that so we can move forward and start making some progress on true prevention of these issues, not just response to them.
I was just clicking on that particular tab on the CAPSA website, education prevention, right? You do have school-based education, I notice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have educators that go into middle and high schools, and they provide conversations about healthy relationships, confidence building, boundary setting, anti-bullying, stepping up and being what's called an upstander, so someone who addresses problematic situations. And then they do also talk about sexual violence, domestic violence, those kinds of things. And then they do support after school clubs at the elementary school level to start really introducing these topics at an age-appropriate manner. And then they go out into communities and do community-based education at libraries and various other places. The goal is really to make sure that we're having these conversations early, because we know that prevention starts when people are young.
I notice you also talk about upstanding. This is something, if you're at USU, you're very familiar with. Mm-hmm. They've really been, I guess this is trying to get us past bystanding, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the idea of bystander intervention is not being someone that watches problematic things happen to other people or even happen to yourself, but actually being willing to step up and say something or do something when you notice problematic situations going on. And there are safe and effective ways to do that, even with as serious of issues as domestic violence and sexual assault.
Well, we just have a few minutes left in the conversation. I want to have maybe, you know, final words here. So, Michaela Hansi, anything you'd like to emphasize at the end of this conversation?
Yeah, you know, I think it's important for people to know that your university, Utah State University, and your community, you know, like CAPSA, we care about this issue, and we are constantly working to address it better, and we need the community's help, too, in doing that. So by hosting this conference, you know, we really want to send the message that this is something that we care about and that we're working on, and we want to constantly be better at. So we really just want people to know that your community cares.
And that support line again for CAPSA, 435-753-2500. You don't have to be a survivor. You could be a friend or family, right? Or clergyman just seeking advice.
Correct, yep.
Yeah. Emily Fishburne, we'll give you the last word. What would you like to emphasize at the end here?
I think just going off of what Michaela said, I think it's so important for all of us to recognize that we have a role to play, right? Not everyone is in maybe an official capacity where they are trying to address these issues every single day or take care of survivors every single day, but all of us really do have a role. And in fact, the only way that we are going to prevent continued generations of trauma and abuse is if everyone plays a role and takes these issues seriously and really steps up and decides to do something about it, whether it's changing their own behaviors or learning more about these issues or finally having that conversation with someone that they maybe believe is having one of these experiences, but they have been too frightened to come forward and say, hey, I think you're experiencing something that isn't okay, and I'm here to help you and support you.
Mm-hmm. So the Northern Utah Conference to End Violence, that'll be on the USU campus Wednesday, May 29th, but you do need to register. It's free, but you need to register. Last day to register is today, so I guess once again, Emily, the website.
The website for the conference is nucev.usu.edu.
We've been talking with CAPSA Social Services Director Michaela Hansi. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And Emily Fishburne, the CAPSA's Director of Projects and Initiatives. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
We'll go out with Wild About Utah.
This is Wild About Utah.
I'm going to go beyond birds a few hundred million years to their precursors, who thrived long before our feathered mini dinosaurs evolved. These ancient beings continue to thrive to us this day, which lured 14 USU students and I to join them in the Mojave wilds of southwestern Utah. We camped at Gunlock State Park, where a Utah DWR herpetologist joined us for several hours, who appeared to know every scaly and slimy critter within a 10-mile radius. A few highlights came when a Smith's black-headed snake was discovered beneath a cow paddy, about the size of a large worm. No one thought it possible to find such a tiny, shy being, unless you're flipping cow poo. Other popular reptiles were the small, delicate banded gecko and the diminutive, invasive Pacific tree frog. Saturday was spent in Snow Canyon State Park, where we were entertained by Cheyenne, a young SUU student naturalist, who kept us riveted with stories on some of the more iconic herp residents. She was emphatic on how to keep the reptiles safe from park visitors and ravens. If a tortoise is crossing the road, please help it to the other side, in the same direction it's headed. Otherwise, never pick them up, for they may release stored water, which could mean the death from dehydration. She also cautioned us on leaving the trail, where the desert tortoise spends much of its life in its labyrinth of burrows. Your footstep could cause a collapse, entombing the animal. Next, Cheyenne pulled a fully mounted Gila monster from her magical tub. Oohs and ahs were audible. The penultimate reptile. She enthralled them with its life history, spending up to 95% of its life underground, often in tortoise burrows, emerging during the spring months for mating and feeding. It may eat one-third of its weight in one meal, consisting of bird, tortoise, and snake eggs, and young mammals, carrion, and whoever else smells delicious and small enough to fit in its ravenous maw. Many of the calories are stored in its tail, which nourishes the animal for much of the year. Amazingly, Gila monster venom is used for diabetes and obesity treatment. Asked if she had seen a Gila monster, "No, but it's at the top of my list," she said. Following a Cheyenne-led hike, we continued the herp search beyond the park boundary. A tortoise discovery brought considerable excitement and photos, a rare sighting. But that was overshadowed a half hour later when a Gila monster decided to present itself to myself. I began shouting, "Monster!" hoping to rein in the dispersed crew. They came scrambling through the creosote bushes in disbelief. We immediately sent a text to Cheyenne with the coordinates, hoping she would see her first monster in the wild. Never have I witnessed more excitement in my students, a surreal moment. I must check with Cheyenne on her success in finding the monster. The Gila monster is considered near threatened by the ICUN from habitat loss and pet trade. In Utah, it is illegal to handle Gila monsters without a permit. This is Jack Green for Bridgerland Audubon Society, and I am wild about Utah and its herps.